Chris in Tennessee, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. Gonna stand my ground, won't be turned around. And I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down.
Good evening and welcome to Revelations Radio Network, Revere Radio Network, iTunes, various podcast sites. My name is Chris. This show is called Nowhere to Run. You can go to our website, which is conspiracyclothes.com/nowheretorun or nowheretorun.podomatic.com. I've got a good show for you today. I'm going to play a very, very interesting and important audio clip from Guy Malone and his radio broadcast. I think it's very crucial information, so we'll get to that in a little bit, and that'll constitute most of the show. Kind of a cop-out today. I'm actually still in the midst of doing some research regarding the rapture, and I know I said I didn't really want to talk about it so much because it was just such a divisive issue, but I don't intend on letting this be a divisive show, and in that intention, I really feel like I need to learn as much as I can to make sure that no glory is given to anybody here but God, so it's going to take me a little bit. And if you guys want to email me your positions on it and the reasons why you feel that way, I would gladly welcome it. My name is Chris, and you can email me at Chris, C-H-R-I-S, at conspiracyclothes.com. I promise you I'll take a look and review the information you send. But I'll need that in order to, you know, just to get a more complete picture of what's going on here. I feel like I've already got some very good information here and stuff that I can't wait to talk about, but I really want to get some more information before I jump into it. So please do that, and we'll get to that. I don't know if it'll be next week, but soon. And also, before we go into the clip, I want to have a correction from last show, and that was I talked about mineral deficiencies and all these different things that we were getting because of the lack of minerals. And I suggested what George Gordon suggested, which was to get a mineral lick or a salt lick from Co-op. And one of my listeners, a guy named Gus, who's been emailing me for a long time, and he emailed me and he said it was just real exciting because he was really into the whole mineral thing, because I guess, if I remember correctly, he was cured from tendinitis because of a mineral deficiency. And so he has been pretty gung-ho about minerals, and he had never heard the salt lick thing before, so he did a little research and found that it's not that the minerals have to be plant-derived, and that a salt lick or mineral lick would not have plant-derived minerals. And so certain plants, especially the organic versions of those plants, would have those minerals in them. And so I will retract that and say, you know, you don't have to go get a salt lick, I don't think. But he suggested a few different ways. One thing, I was in a health food store the other day in Bowling Green, Ohio, and asked him about this, and they pointed me to this kind of like a green food, superfood kind of thing. It's called organic frog, I think. But basically, it had, in addition to a lot of stuff like probiotics and stuff, it had a lot of vitamin issues. But it was all from organic plants. But it had a lot of these minerals that were derived from plants. And so it's one of these like things where you mix like a cup of the powder with water or something, and it's absolutely terrible. But I'm convinced that it's an acquired taste. I just really need to get after it. But so that's one way. And you know, something like that, the one I mentioned there is actually pretty cheap. So anyway, let me play this clip. It's totally unrelated to that. And it is, it's from Guy Malone's radio show. It's a guy, I'm not even have an internet connection where I'm recording this. So I don't know the guy's name that he's interviewing. I'm sure he mentions it a number of times. He is a guy very much like Russ Dizdar. He's a counselor of people with dissociative identity disorder and multiple personality disorder. He has seen a lot of those events, and he has some very important information all throughout the interview that is crucial to understand. A lot of a lot of insight, things that I hadn't heard before, a lot of stuff about different underground bases and potential possibilities for all kinds of stuff going on with what they are trying to build and all that kind of stuff. So we'll play this clip, and it is it was sent to me or recommended to me by my friend Lynn. Thank you, Lynn, for this. Okay, that's the end of this section, so thanks for tuning in. If you can email me at chris@conspiracyclose.com. Be sure to send me any of your rapture viewpoints and scriptures associated with it so I can have some stuff to look at and to weigh. Thank you for your time. I'll see you next week. Later.
Program live from Roswell. Sometimes we're UFO themed, sometimes we're paranormal, politics, and or religious in nature. Sometimes we're light and fun, but tonight is not one of those nights, as my guest tonight is Doug Riggs, and our topic is healing from the effects of satanic ritual abuse and mind control, which often... Sorry about that. Wasn't me. But this often leaves people suffering from dissociative disorders, such as multiple personalities, and Doug works in healing people that have issues and problems with that going on, as well as educating others that it is a real topic. Quite a serious topic, and I'm sure we're going to touch on some kind of dark subjects as we go along. And I would like to remind you, listeners, you can participate in this discussion and ask questions by calling us toll-free with a question for Doug at 877-786-0562, or just send me your questions for Doug via email at talktome, T-A-L-K-T-O-M-E, at livefromroswell.com, and I'll read them on the air. And a quick reminder to our virtual auditorium that I'm not usually available to follow every comment, so I'm often away from the auditorium for half an hour at a time. So if you want your comments entered into the discussion tonight, please be sure and use the email or the phone number listed on www.livefromroswell.com. Doug, first off, just welcome to the program tonight.
Thank you, Guy. It's a pleasure to be able to talk with you for the first time.
Yeah, at least over the telephone or anything. Doug has a good mailing list I've been on. I've seen articles from in the past. And I know you are busy, so thanks for taking some time out from the work just really to educate us on all this tonight. It's a, like I said, very serious topic, eh?
Yeah, and I just a clarification, I really do not have the capacity to heal anyone from dissociative disorders or any of the effects of any type of sadistic abuse, but I'm able to facilitate and to watch the Lord do what he does through human instruments, and so it's really his domain.
Got it. Well, you work with, correct me if I'm wrong, survivors, or I would have to say victims of ritualistic abuse, right?
Yes, I've been working in that field since 1986 and worked with several hundred people who have varying degrees of complexity and background, dissociative disorders from reactive DID all the way up to highly structured DID or dissociative disorders, which is formerly known as multiple personality disorder.
And you say since 1986, how did you personally get involved in the field?
Well, I was teaching a Bible church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, just basic teachings of the Word, exegetical studies, and I noticed there are a number of people who were not able to go free from certain encumbrances and interferences in their spiritual life and their marriage relationships, and so I began to do some biblical counseling, is the best I knew how at the time, and went as far as I could with that, and there were certain folks that were not being resolved, and then I heard about multiple personality disorder in 1990, and then when I read Jim Friesen's book, Uncovering the Mystery of MPD, and started to share some of these insights that he talked about in his book, some of the people switched into child altars, and basically said, I've been waiting for you to see if we'd be believed, otherwise they wouldn't start presenting some of their multiplicity until they knew for certain that they would be believed and not told that they were crazy. Excuse me.
So just from the effects of being a pastor in what might be otherwise called a normal church?
Yeah, basically just a Bible church, non-denominational Bible church. And most of my training came from through the Dallas Seminary type of background, so it was anything but this type of venue.
And you ran into people that were having much more, I don't know, serious problems? Or what kind of issues were you running into that made you realize that there was a wall you had to get past?
Well, for example, excuse me, trying to do biblical counseling, I was with this young lady one time, and I was asking her to read the Bible, and we were going to start doing some renunciations based upon what we understood at the time, renunciation of some generational issues, and she reported that she was seeing the letters on the page of her Bible upside down, and it was like she was staring through a tunnel. And when we got to renouncing, trying to get her to renounce some connection with one of her family members, she froze and she was not able to speak. And so I knew I was, you know, we'd known this person for a number of years. We knew we were getting into something that was, that I had not been trained for, nor was I presented any of this type of phenomenon in my seminary training.
Is it like do you liken the dissociative disorders to paranormal, spiritual, or possession, or anything like that?
No, not at all. In fact, a possession can only really refer to an unbeliever, but believers, because of chronic trauma and fragmented or dissociative states, they can be demonized and have various attachments. And so, therefore, you have to distinguish between the disorder that is trauma-based and then the infiltration or the contamination or attachments of the demonic, which introduces itself during the trauma.
So that comes afterwards?
Well, actually, if it's structured DID, where people abuse children from the earliest childhood, they do it in order to cause splitting and to channel in spirits and to structure them to become a weapon, basically, and often in local churches and various other venues.
How do they become a weapon?
By purposely causing them to split from earliest childhood and then passing on to them various spirits or principalities and structuring them to carry out various agendas in terms of global politics and within the church to advance the satanic kingdom and ultimately prepare this world for the coming of Antichrist.
Oh, wow. The term we started the show with is either ritual abuse or satanic ritual abuse. And I'm sure there's a lot of directions we could go. Just to catch myself, listeners, and educators, can you just give me an overview of what the term satanic ritual abuse means? What is it?
Well, first of all, people who are split or multiples, as we refer to, or have dissociative identity disorder, that can come about through lack of positive nurturance, any type of childhood conflicts or any type of mental, emotional, or spiritual abuse. If it's not ritual abuse, then the internal structure, the dividedness of the mind, will be reactive. But if it is ritual, that is, there is some form of religious and spiritual connotation, groups meeting, you know, abusing children for the purpose of indoctrination and causing them to split through trauma, then their internal DID or dissociative structure will become highly complex and structured to carry out the agenda of a local occult, a local cult, or if it's on an international level, it's connected with the New World Order.
So there's groups that are doing this on purpose?
Absolutely. No question about it. It's all clearly documented in many places, both by secular and non-secular people. The Nazi, Josef Mengele and other Nazi doctors perfected some of these techniques that are used. They were passed on to the CIA through Operation Paperclip and to create agents that didn't know that they were agents at one level, but the deeper level is very hidden, and it's all designed to hide certain royal families of their agenda to bring in their Christ.
And what is their Christ? You said Antichrist earlier.
Yeah, they don't refer him to Antichrist. They just, yeah, there's a book written by Dr. Marie Tanner, who is a secular historian, I think a Harvard graduate. She wrote a book called The Last Descendant of Aeneas, and she refers to the last bloodline being the Habsburgs, which is really not it. They kind of died out at World War II. But she describes the ideology of those various Merovingian kings, you know, the Da Vinci Code kind of ideology to bring in their Christ, and they're very dedicated to this. They believe that the last descendant of Aeneas, who was the progenitor of Rome, Romulus and Remus, and the foundation of Rome, they believe that this individual will through various bloodlines be able to emerge as one who is qualified to be the world ruler, and that's their ideology. And Marie Tanner clearly documents that in her book, The Last Descendant of Aeneas.
If anybody wants to look it up, is it M-A-R-I-E Tanner?
Yes, T-A-N-N-E-R, and it's Aeneas, A-E-N-E-A-S, I believe, Aeneas. Aeneas is, it goes back to when Troy was destroyed by the Greeks, and the little grandchild that survived. The king of Troy was Aeneas, and his grandsons, Romulus and Remus, were the founders of Rome. I think Romulus killed one of the brothers, and then, that's kind of how the storyline goes for the foundation of Rome. So the last descendant of Aeneas would be the world ruler, the head of the revived Roman Empire, as we know in terms of biblical prophecy.
How would someone just know that this ruler is on the scene, or that this person is of that bloodline?
Well, my understanding of Scripture, there are three things in 2 Thessalonians there that he's not going to be revealed until certain things take place. One is a great falling away, and then the Antichrist will set himself up in the temple of God, and the restrainer is removed, and then he will be revealed. So as long as the restrainer is doing his activity, and I think it's the church that the restrainer is operating through, with the removal of the church, the restraining ministry of the Holy Spirit will be removed, and then Antichrist will be revealed. So as long as the church here, we can't pinpoint the actual identity, but I personally believe that he is alive today, and although we don't know, because the adversary probably has several in the wings to cover his agenda, because he's not in control of history. But I do believe he's alive today. But I don't personally believe that we can say, hey, this guy is the Antichrist.
It would be more a case of whoever steps into that position at the right time in history more just by not so much random, but you're saying there could be many Antichrists, and one will ultimately just step right into the world stage at that time?
Yeah, in fact, 1 John refers to there's the spirit of Antichrist, there are many Antichrists, and then he says there's the coming Antichrist. So you have three different ways in which Antichrist is used in 1 John. And so the adversary, since he's not in control of history, he has to have preparation. So I would imagine he has, perhaps, I don't know if the terminology is right, a gene pool, if you will, of some in reserve, so when the time comes, he has his man prepared.
So you think whoever will be the Antichrist is from a specific bloodline that is on purpose breeding or grooming him might be the right way to say it?
My belief is that the Antichrist and the false prophet will be Nephilim, and the reason why I believe this is that in the Scripture, in the book of Revelation, it mentions that when Jesus Christ returns, that the false prophet and the Antichrist will be removed and thrown into the lake of fire before the millennial reign of Christ and before the great white throne judgment, which indicates to me that they're not truly fully human, because if they're fully human, why wouldn't they stand before God at the great white throne judgment in Revelation 21? But with reference to the false prophet and the Antichrist, they are thrown into the lake of fire, the place of final judgment, before the millennial reign of Christ. So that would indicate to me that they fit into the category of Nephilim. And Pember mentions in his book, Earth's Earliest Ages, that there will be three eruptions. First eruption, Genesis 6, of fallen angels to produce the offspring of Nephilim. There was a smaller, more confined or restrictive population of Nephilim in the land of Canaan prior to the Israelites' preoccupation of the land. Then he mentions in his book that just prior to the return of the Son of Man, there'll be a third and final eruption of fallen angels producing the offspring of Nephilim in the earth, which I have the quotation document of his book right here in front of me.
Oh, that's from Earth's Earliest Ages. Right.
Right. That was written, I believe, in 1873 by a very renowned biblical scholar, G.H. Pember, P-E-M-B-E-R. The book is still available.
I don't mind you quoting from that now. on that topic?
Well, if people read the book, it's quite an amazing piece in that it was written 140 years ago. But he talks about the false Christ that will be coming and the false messiahs, you know, prior to the coming of Christ. And then he says, lastly, the characteristic features of the days of Noah are reappearing. And above all, free communication has been established between the spirits of the air and the human race with a view, apparently, to a sojourn once more of the Nephilim upon the earth. Unlawful secrets known in past times only to those few who seem to have acted as Satan's agents in directing the course of this world are now recklessly offered to all men. And he continues on, and I won't read all of it to you, but he goes on the next page, he says, it thus appears that this long-expected event, that is, the third and final eruption of Nephilim, will precede Satan's banishment from heaven in Revelation 12, and therefore also its results, the revival of the Roman Empire and the revelation of the man of sin. Like Enoch, the Church of Christ will be carried, called away before the earth is for a time abandoned to the Nephilim, before the fearful woes of the end. If then the fallen angels appear to be already preparing for their descent, if the great apostasy which will at last evolve the lawless one be even now spreading, who can be sure of the day or the hour? Unquote.
Wow. So that involves at least two themes I pick up on then, is the restrainer and the church are still in the earth. You're saying that the restrainer mentioned in Scripture is the church?
No, in the passage there, he says, you know what restrains, and until he who is restraining is removed. First, the neuter gender is used as a scriptural reference to God the Holy Spirit, because that we see in John the same kind of syntax and grammatical usage is used in the neuter. So there it refers to the characteristic function of God the Holy Spirit, who is, he's the only one that can restrain Antichrist. There's no one else can do that. And so it has to be a person of the Godhead. In this case, I believe that the indirect reference in that passage is referring to God the Holy Spirit. And then and the personal pronoun is used following there in that passage, and says, and then until he is taken out of the way. That is, until he is removed as a restraining influence on the earth. In the Great Tribulation period, the Holy Spirit is here because there will be conversions, but he's no longer restraining Antichrist. Antichrist will be allowed to appear. And so that, I believe that, along with myself and any other premillennial scholars, believe that that restraining ministry of the Holy Spirit is operative to the church as salt and light in the earth.
Which, the second topic then, you said premillennial, or... Is that a pre-tribulation rapture?
Right,
point of view,
yeah.
Then?
Okay. Pre-tribulation, because there's when it comes to premillennial eschatology or study of last things, you have three categories: pre-tribulation, mid-tribulation, post-tribulation views. If we understand the true doctrine of imminency, that is, there are no signs that need to occur before Jesus Christ returns for his church. The only possible scenario that accepts true imminency would be a pre-tribulation rapture. If you place a rapture anywhere beyond that, then you can no longer have imminency in terms of signs, because Israel and the last days, there will be numerous signs. We have the seal judgments in Revelation 6, followed by the trumpet judgments and the bowl judgments. These all are clear signs, and so if there's not a pre-tribulation rapture, then we've got to look for certain signs before the Lord will return. And we don't have that, especially in the Pauline epistles. And some of the earliest circulated epistles, like 1 and 2 Thessalonians, which clearly deal with the coming of the Lord for the church.
Okay, and you said earlier that a lot of the ritualistic abuse is to help bring about this Antichrist, or to prepare the world for it. How is the... Can you seg back into how that works?
Well, it's a kind of thing that... It takes a whole seminar to really develop and give a biblical framework. But this is a difficult thing to explain. But the spiritual realm is the most real, and the adversary knows very well how we are made. We are tripartite. We are spirit, soul, and body. 1 Thessalonians 5:23. And so when a little child is assaulted by some person that is, you know, a generational wacko in the family, or some, you know, programmer who is, you know, a sorcerer and working for some of the royal families, they're going to do their thing. But during the process of abuse and whatever they do, then there is an interfacing with the powers of darkness with the individual and during the assault. This interfacing, this enmeshment, this kind of lamination, if you will, of the spiritual kingdom of darkness with the individual in terms of his spirit and his soul is highly complex, very, very highly structured. And as I have worked with this for years, I've become aware that the internal architecture and structure is way beyond the intelligence of a human being. And so even though human beings are the agents, we can sometimes call them programmers, what actually results is way beyond that of the intelligence of the human being. And so the undoing of these things and seeing a person set free involves the supernatural intervention and wisdom of God. But it is the whole theme and agenda is preparing the world for the coming of Antichrist, and plus prior to that, the coming collapse of what we know as governments, to prepare the way for the Antichrist to come and resolve the big problem and unite the world or the nations under his leadership. So we're going to be in for some major shaking and interference with our establishment. And that's all part of preparing the world for the coming need to have a superhuman to come on the scene and resolve the world problems. And so there's going to be an interface there with, you know, the time in which we live, and then the final coming of the rapture, which will be a rescue, according to 1 Thessalonians 1:10. A rescue from what? I mean, 1 Thessalonians 5:9 says it's a deliverance from the wrath to come. So we're in for some real perilous times, as Paul said in 2 Timothy 3:1. It's time for judgment to begin at the household of God, 1 Peter 4:17. So I think the church is asleep in the West, basically, not all every church, but most of them that I've been connected with. And we're going to have a rude awakening perhaps in the very near future and find out that, you know, everything that we thought was, you know, good old United States of America is going to change perhaps overnight. And there are plenty of agents in place to take, to take care of things when martial law is declared. If a national emergency comes in, there are a lot of dissociative agents in place to carry out their assigned tasks. And I believe that it's going to be a real time of shaking that is coming on the church in the West and in the world.
Okay, tell me about the agents that they are in place now.
Well, I can only speak from my experience, and there are, you know, a number of the people that came to the assembly that I pastored. They were there because, you know, they were truly Christian, but they also had structured into their DID system various agendas directed towards me against the purpose of God. Through dissociative states, they could be going to rituals, or they were going to rituals, in the evening and night, and then coming to church on Sunday morning, you know, not knowing why they're so tired, sometimes wearing dark glasses and stuff, you know, they had no way of knowing. But as we got into the internal world and undoing this stuff, we began to connect with different aspects of these people's dissociative identity parts of themselves, and these agendas began to be unraveled and pieced together through the years. Quite an elaborate pre-planned agenda to weaken the church and to bring down pastors and to come alongside leaders and to blackmail them and to do all kinds of things, you know. I mean, just to bring about lawlessness, basically the breakdown of establishment, law and order, and everything that represents a divinely ordained establishment.
So not so much targeted at you personally, but you're saying there's...
No, I was targeted personally. I was targeted, because as a pastor, you know, I mean, especially as I started going into this work, I mean, I had a number of threats and, I had various things happening directed towards me because I stepped into this arena.
Yeah, once you started attacking it.
or actually dismantling the secrets and that where nobody's supposed to know about it, and they're all locked up behind dissociative amnesic walls in these people's minds, you know, and this starts coming down and the agenda and things come out, and you know, and then that exposes the very thing that the enemy, I think it's 2 Thessalonians 2:7, the mystery of iniquity is now working, and the word mystery means secret. It's a secret until it's revealed.
So, in general, if I'm following you correctly, I want to make sure I am, for the sake of the listeners as well, is that in general, you're saying that there are people with what we'd call multiple personalities that are members of government and of churches that, on purpose, because they're programmed to, actually introduce anarchy or some sort of destruction to that entity?
I don't say they're introduced. They for example, if you watch, world leaders and politicians, and there are ones that should be very familiar to us, but because of, I am not going to say certain things over the phone because of echelon and things like that, but if you look at political leaders, I can tell by their eye movements, and I can tell by what they say and then watch what they do that they're probably pre-programmed. Our more recent political figures and heads are always spouting some kind of political rhetoric, but they never follow through. And they always have certain choice words that seem to be sounding good, but there's never any follow through. And so this is kind of a typical programmed way that people function. And I'm not saying all of them are that way. You can have just a crooked politician, because he's a crooked politician. But, I watch some of these guys that are pretty obvious, and I've seen it so many times in my counseling office that, you know, people say they equivocate, say one thing, and they do another. And so this is, you know, kind of what's going on. But I think the important thing is that the adversary knows how to maintain a network. Rather, that on the human level, there's a full awareness of this network. He is networked, and he knows how to position and move things into place to serve his own agenda, whether the human agents are aware of it or not.
So there's likely people, both in churches and in politics, that are somehow programmed in.
Oh, there's no question about it. Yeah, I mean, I've worked with them and that have been in high places with government. I worked with numerous people who were in the planning phases of the assassination of Kennedy. They have inside information. They know how the plans went down. It was definitely a conspiracy that came down out of London, and it worked its way down to the CIA and down worked itself out to probably the execution through a mafia or something. So it was multi-layered, so that you could never trace it back to its true planning phase. But anyone that's studied the Kennedy assassination knows very well that the magic bullet theory, the Warren Commission is totally physically impossible, and that, you know, I saw the Pruder film, for example, before it was edited, and there were like 5 shots fired, and from 3 different angles, triangulated fire, and so it was clearly a conspiracy, but you can't bring that up. So you got to narrow it down to one guy up there in the book repository. So that was all clearly an occult killing from all the information I've got from reading, as well as working with people who were in the occult and who described their various roles and connections with people in certain powers that wanted him taken out.
Why?
After his first term... It's the same reason they killed Lincoln. There were 5 people that were involved in the assassination of Lincoln. John Wilkes Booth was only one. There were 5 involved. It's the same reason the National Bank back then, which is now called the National Reserve, Lincoln wanted to bring the control and issuance of currency back under the control of Congress as per the Constitution. And so he began to issue greenbacks. And because of that, he was flying in the face of the agenda of the national banks maintaining control over the issue of currency. So he was taken out for that particular stand against the national bank. And Kennedy, I was told, I don't remember the source on this, but after his first term, he mentioned if he's reelected, one of his first things on his agenda was to bring the control and issuance of currency out from the control of the Federal Reserve and bring it back under the control of Congress. Well, you know, you're running into the same powers that went after Lincoln for the very same reason. So it wasn't long until, you know, after that particular statement that he made on one of his political speeches that he was a maverick. He was not going to go along with the agenda of the New World Order, so he was removed.
Help define the New World Order, because you mentioned the banking, obviously.
Yeah, there are a number of books written on this, very excellent writers, and I don't remember all of them now. There's various layers to all this. You've heard of the Bilderbergers. They are just various national and international leaders that meet for a secret agenda. And the first one was the Bilderberg Motel, I believe, and somewhere in France. I forgot the name of it. But they meet annually, highly top secret. People guard the place with machine guns. And nobody knows for sure what they talk about. But you have world leaders, heads of state, highly wealthy, business people who attend these, you know, Club of Rome, and their whole agenda is they believe that the oligarchy of plutocrats, that is these leaders who believe that they are the enlightened ones, they have the right to rule, and their desire is to bring the whole world under a one world system of government and economics, and ultimately there'll be a one world religion. So it's spiritually driven, although it is an ideology that governs a number of these heads of state.
Okay, we're not taking a break at the bottom of the hour like we often do. I just definitely want to remind people that you can pose a question or jump in on this conversation by calling toll-free 877-786-0562 or email me at talktome@livefromroswell.com, and I'll read that on the air. We will take a break at the top of this hour, but we're going to keep on continuing with Doug right now. And you've drawn a picture. I found you're very good at speaking matter-of-factly about things that I or a lot of the guests may have only heard of, like when you say the Bilderbergers or the New World Order. So you definitely believe that there's a, and you've worked with it, people that were programmed to be part of the New World Order.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, no question about it. In fact, people talk about conspiracy theory. I said, you know what? The onus is upon those who call themselves historians to prove it's a theory, because I've got numerous scriptures that talk about the wicked plot against the righteous, and Psalm 2 and many other psalms, Psalm 83. When you have more than two conspiring to wipe out the nation of Israel or wipe out the righteous, you've got a conspiracy going. Well, that's the human side of things. You know, the kings of the earth take their stand against the Lord and his anointed. You know, they conspire as a tumultuous throng, as it says in the Hebrew. So that's not a theory. It's a biblical fact. So, whether people understand it or not is an issue with them and their understanding of biblical revelation as well as history, because there's plenty of good historians that have documented this reality.
True. Do you affirm, like, the book's rule by secrecy and the Jim Mars line of thinking on this? I mention that because I think a lot more of our audience is familiar with that.
Yeah, I haven't read those. I read Nesta Webster and years ago, and I read James Robeson. He wrote a book in 1799, Proofs of the Conspiracy, and Daniel Ryder is the book that he came and interviewed us called The Cover-Up of the Century, A Satanic Ritual, Crime, and World Conspiracy by Daniel Ryder, Fourth Reich of the Rich by Des Griffin, which is a very excellent little book. Another one is The New World Order by William Still. It's very brief, but it's a good overview. Doesn't deal with DID. Another one that I just noticed that is going to be released again is called The Omega Conspiracy, Satan's Last Assault on God's Kingdom by I.D.E. Thomas.
Oh, that is being re-released now?
Yeah, it's supposed to be out sometime this spring. And that's a real good one because he really understands and grasps, you know, the whole context of Genesis 6, 1 through 4 being played out as the final drama of the end times.
Oh, talk about that for a second, because I know a lot of people in my field talk about Genesis 6, Nephilim, fallen angels, crossbreeding, and that goes right into the ritualistic abuse topic, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Studies.
Yeah, well, these people, you know, these authors are not talking about the ritual abuse side. They're just really dealing with the historical and the biblical. But on Satan's last assault on God's kingdom, I.D. Thomas really ties in the whole UFO phenomenon and the Genesis 6 eruption producing, you know, these hybrids known as Nephilim. He ties that into the whole end-time scenario and you know, the phenomenon of UFOs. I mean, he ties it together, I think, very well. Excuse me.
On the hybridization, Hilly writes, just to someone that's listening, about Daniel 2, chapter 2, saying that when people use that in reference to the crossbreeding, that it says the clay will not mix with iron. And I don't have the exact quote in front of me.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, actually, it doesn't. It say it will not adhere. There is a mixture, and if you go back and I'll get the passage and I'll read it. So, and I heard Chuck Missler discuss this one time. I thought it was a very excellent consideration that he made, talking about the ten toes. That is the final configuration of the revived Roman Empire in terms of the image of Daniel 2. He says there in Daniel 2:42, and the toes of the feet were partly of iron, partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will not combine together, they will combine with one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another. Even as iron does not combine with pottery. So when it says combined to one another, the word combined means through intermarriage. And one of the agendas of the ruling monarchies of Europe, those that carry the Merovingian ideology of the Gnostic Christ, is that through the right combination of bloodlines, they'll eventually emerge the last descendant of Aeneas or the rule of the coming king, the Roman emperor. And so this mixture there in that passage that we saw is not a human. In other words, this not combined with the seed of men, that would seem to indicate by inference a third eruption, as Pember says, of fallen angels cohabiting with women, producing Nephilim in the last stage of world history leading up to the coming of the Son of Man, Jesus Christ. In fact, if you read Revelation chapter 9, you see those very grotesque creatures that are coming out of the abyss. The question is, who are they? If these are the disembodied spirits of Nephilim that have been imprisoned, or they are the fallen angels that have been locked up in prison, as we see in 2 Peter and Jude, if they're released and they are manifesting themselves in this very grotesque way, then maybe Revelation 9 is not so metaphorical or symbolic as some would say, but it could be a very horrendous event that God is going to use to judge those who have rejected Jesus Christ.
Do you believe that intermingling is going on now, or is
yes, I do.
Still to come?
Yes, no, I believe it's already going on. I believe it's been going on at least since World War II.
That there's what I guess biblical scholars would use the phrase Nephilim,
right?
A hybrid of angels and human.
That's
beings.
Correct. Yeah, I believe that's true. I remember working with a member of the royal family and in Europe. The member of the royal family is from the House of Windsor, and this particular daughter, who looks very much like her father, very tall and blonde. Her husband was an officer and out there on the West Coast, California, I forgot what the name of it is, Vandenberg. And he is, also had access to the Pentagon and had pretty high clearance. And as I began to work with this woman, traveling out to see her and doing work, we kind of burrowed down a lot of the various defenses and barriers that had purposely been put in place to hide her bloodline. When we got down into some of this, very interesting things, she began to talk about Area 51.
Is this the person that came to you for counseling? How do you know this?
I've been sought out, all over the United States. So, they had called me from, I think it was Nevada, and wanted to meet with me, so I started meeting with them. But she told me about being taken out to Area 51. And she says, everyone talks about Area 51, which we know it's a real thing, even though the government denies it. Stealth planes have been developed and stuff that, in that particular facility. But she says, people talk about Area 51, but what most people don't know is that there's Area 52. And the people that work in Area 51 don't even know about Area 52. I said, what do you mean Area 52? He says, well, that's the Nephilim Project.
Yeah.
He said, that's below Area 51. And here she said, you have to have a certain kind of clearance. And when we got in past some of her dissociative defenses, she says, I know the number. I can go anywhere. I can go into Area 51. All I got to do is give my number. And so what she did, she gave her husband this number. He checked it out in the database. This number was higher than anything that he knew of in the Pentagon, and that it was the very number was assigned to those that could not even be named. It was a very top clearance, and he verified that the number that his wife had was not only way beyond his, but beyond anything that was allowed to even give a name to be assigned to.
You just walk up to Area 51, recite a number? And
no. No, there are tunnels. You don't walk up there.
Okay, well, sure. Okay,
there are underground tunnels and stuff. There's a tunnel. She told me, I haven't been there, but she mentioned it from Las Vegas, that she's taken a 10-minute ride from Las Vegas right into Groom Lake, which is about an hour and 4 minute drive by car, that she was transported there within a 10-minute underground ride on a high speed, very quiet rail system, whatever that is. I have no way of knowing, but that's what she described to me. And she was very highly structured and taken all over the world and done all kinds of, was paraded by various heads of state. So it's pretty, it's a Canaanite culture, a Babylonian culture, if you will.
Okay, and you mentioned that you had worked past some of her disassociative walls or something. How does that work? What are you actually dealing with when you got someone who's, just split or multiple?
Yeah, it's very complex. I don't know that I could really describe that guy on the phone because when you're dealing with just the phenomenon of dissociation itself, the person has a number of psychological or human defenses. You have to be able to identify those defenses. And through a protocol of certain questions and answers, I can begin to see how the structure, the defensive structure is put in place and begin to work and, decontaminate some of these areas from spiritual attachments and help the person get to the trauma base and to help bring these various dissociated aspects of their identity out of the past and into the present so they can begin to reclaim their life and in gradually be restored to function, which is a very long and drawn-out process.
I can imagine, actually. That would be so. And a lot of this happens on purpose to people through ritualistic abuse when they're young.
If it's ritual abuse, going back to your first question, then it's always purposely done to cause splitting so that what they call programming and structuring can be done to carry out an agenda within that particular cult or often a more wider or broader ideology of what I refer to as the New World Order.
Is this just like you take an average 3 or 5 year old and are you just kind of playing the odds? When you do this to a lot of people, that some of them are going to rise to power, or some of them are going to wind up in churches or government.
My experience is that they have to be born in a certain bloodline to carry the generational base of power and the sin issue that is accumulated with certain bloodlines. But now they're born into this family. They're abused, electroshocked, whether they're still in their mother's womb, the score, to enhance predisposition to dissociation and abuse from infants on up through childhood, so that they are completely, absolutely structured in a way that is beyond any human protocol to see them set free without divine intervention. It really, you know, you take somebody to the level that I'm talking about or that I'm aware of. There is no psychological protocol to get them out. It just usually a lot of these people they're just presenting as borderline personality disorder, and they're so fragmented you don't even see switching. All you see is borderline features. And when you get somebody like that, you know, you talk to any psychologist or any counselor that is working with someone who has what they call borderline personality disorder, there's not much hope for them. I mean, I worked with one person with full-blown DID, but that person only presented borderline for 10 years before I saw a first switch. And so it's, you know, it can be pretty messy, but, you know, the Lord has made a way for anyone to come out if they, you know, have a heart to come out and follow Him out. It's a journey with the Lord out of this mess.
And what's your role in facilitating someone through that?
Just through experience, just understanding how things structure and helping them get to their core identity, which is often very hidden, and working through the dissociative defenses and helping them reclaim their life that has basically been taken from them before they were even had the ability to make a choice.
Someone writes in, do you mean generational curses?
Well, generational curse, I mean, depending on the particular agenda, the family wants, they call it an inheritance. And so maintain the power structure or the family inheritance, these family spirits, these principalities that are passed on to their children, I would say that's a curse, you know, but from their perspective, they call it the inheritance, you know. So, yeah, there are curses. There are a number of things that, you know, the whole thing has to be, the whole area of dissociation and dividedness and fragmentation is like a reservoir, a repository where these principalities can attach themselves and to basically carry out a stealth agenda through an amnesic presenter. And that is what is going on and is going on in our churches and all, in all kinds of ways, and a lot of these people don't even know that they're agents because they're amnesic to the fact that they even have this history.
And what triggers them to begin to work out the disorder or the programming?
Well, it varies with different people. Usually depression. They're very depressed. They feel very empty, or they dissatisfied with their spiritual life, or you know, unfulfilled in normal relationships. But I think most women just enter because of depression, and very severe depression. Some are suicidal. I've had a number of people who have come to me who tried to commit suicide, who have been in mental hospitals and everything. And so, you know, they've had problems, but most often it's a bit misdiagnosed. You know, they said they're psychotic, or they got bipolar, or you know, they're schizophrenic, and you know, it's just, you know, depending on who the clinician is, they will often misdiagnose them. But you know, the ones I worked with, some of them have varying degrees of history of you know, mental institutions.
And like, so you're saying there is a real thing such as bipolar and schizophrenia?
I don't know. I mean, I only work with what I work with, so I'm not qualified to answer that because I'm not a clinician. I just know that I've had people come to me say that this is how they've been diagnosed and they've been full-blown DID. So that doesn't mean every disorder out there is DID. I just, you know, if they've had chronic abuse in their childhood, then the only way they could have survived is to split, because DID is really a childhood form of PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, when the little children are overwhelmed by chronic trauma and abuse, they split. If it's an adult, they don't split. They just, you know, they present PTSD, like our troops coming back from Iraq.
Sure. So when a child, is this just any trauma, like physical or sexual abuse, or, you know, the neighbor's house explodes and it scares them at night, or alien abduction and things like that? I know there's a lot of overlap, I think, in the alien abduction SRA field.
Yeah, well, anything that's, I mean, an acute trauma is not going to produce DID. It has to be chronic trauma. And chronic trauma or lack of positive nurturance or chaos and conflict or all of the above can produce fragmentation or splitting in a child, and so they will, you know, they'll organize into either a random DID structure in their mind or structured if it's cult perpetrated. So these people, when they begin to present their different problems, they don't often know what's going on. What I do is I just do a history and do some generational prayer work and renouncing and breaking anything that might represent the sins of the fathers. And if they're a DID and I begin to do some generational prayer work just to kind of open the door a little bit, it'll open things up big time. So, you know, I have a protocol that I use to, certain questions to ask. To find out if they are through. Some people come to me with various problems in the past, and they thought they were through. They've been to professionals, and I ask two or three questions, and I can tell if they're really done or not. Because, you know, often the present protocol is really dealing with the outer structure of things, and the deeper core levels can be very, very hidden, especially with those who are highly structured. So the core areas are more associated with the realm of the human spirit, as I come to understand it, and not the very central connection with God, but there are, you know, areas in which the human spirit can be affected. And so it's a very complex thing, but I don't want to scare anybody, because the Lord is very aware of each person's need, and each person is special to Him, and Jesus Christ is kinsman redeemer. And He is committed to each person and walking out that journey with them until every area of their life that was taken captive through trauma and dissociation is released and set free. So we're seeing that happen among some of the folks here. And so I would want people to listen to this not to be too overwhelmed by the magnitude of this evil, because no matter how big the evil is, God is always infinitely greater, and He understands the needs of each person.
Very well said. How do people, I guess you're known in this field, obviously. You said you're contacted from people all over the United States.
Yeah, I've kind of backed away a little bit, because I wanted to make sure that I got a few folks through that I would have been committed to me at for a long time, and seeing them get through has been really important to me. So I use a lot of discretion now before I accept anyone. If they're not committed or in a good local church somewhere where they can have support, I will not accept any assignments. They have to have somebody who's committed to walk with them through this, or I don't accept it. So yeah, in the past, we've had seminars. We have people from Germany and South Africa and Australia, and people throughout the United States that have come. But what I've learned now, a guy in the last probably 4 years has really brought a whole different focus to me, and I think for me, for those working this field, I would want to make sure they understood the spiritual paradigm, the spiritual framework in which to operate, not excluding the psychological dimension, that is the human, the way things break and are defined in terms of DID. I don't mean bypassing that, but to really understand the spiritual framework so that the person that you're working with is equipped on a spiritual level to make the journey, because it's really, really a big challenge for a person to get out of this.
And how many people over the years would you say you've actually personally worked with and counseled through this?
Oh, gosh, there's been lots of... I tried to figure that out one time. I would say probably between 200 or 300.
200 or 300, and you work with a church that has a lot of people from this background that worship with you now?
Yeah, we have a handful here that have really gone the distance, and plus I've been in touch with people that are other assemblies that I help guide and mentor, that they're doing the work because it's too big of a job for just a guy like me. So I'm more interested in seen people trained that are called to come alongside these folks and walk this out with them. So, you know, that's where I am is, you know, working. I don't want to take on a lot of people more now. Take on more people right now.
Oh, sure.
But those others that are working to help them and coach them along to help the people that they're working with.
Right, that can multiply the effort
right,
a lot better than one
because
person
I'm getting
doing
it's
all.
It's too demanding to do the work all yourself. Yeah.
We're at the top of the hour. We're going to take about a 6 or 7 minute break with commercials and music. And when we come back, I'll ask you a couple things about how prevalent is this? You know, is it in every culture, every society, every city? What do people look for? How do you recognize it? Things like that. And you can also, folks listening, you can jump into the conversation. Just send me an email, talktome@livefromroswell.com. I've got one we'll start out with here in a little bit. But right now we're going to do about a 6-7 minute break, and we'll be back with Pastor Doug Riggs. Welcome back to Live from Roswell. I'm Guy Malone, your host. We're broadcasting globally on the Paranormal Radio Network, and we're about halfway through our conversation with Doug Riggs, and we were discussing satanic ritual abuse, DID, or dissociative identity disorder, multiple personalities, some of the effects that this abuse has on people and indoctrinating them or making them agents of New World Order type kind of things. And you can join us or send an email to me at talktome@livefromroswell.com or call in toll free at 877-786-0562. We do this every week on the Paranormal Radio Network. We're holding at around 50,000 listeners right now. So if you sounds like a passive audience tonight with what we've got going on. And Doug, I'm thinking that at the top of the hour, since the topic is satanic ritual abuse, you're dealing with a topic that, like a lot of people on this program, that there's not a lot of people that even believe this is going on, or at least they're not very aware of it. And I'm just curious, first off, how prevalent in our society is this phenomenon you're talking about?
You know, I'll give you two tracks to answer that. A number of years ago, when this first came to my attention in our local assembly, there were people that we've been working with and we've known for over 10 years. And as we began to work in this area, the whole DID or MPD didn't begin to surface until after about 5 years into the counseling and, of course, knowing some of these people for over 10 years. And so it was very hidden. And the reason why it was hidden is because the whole person who is divided, or MPD, or now known as DID, it's even hidden to themselves. Because in order to survive, they really couldn't know. So dissociation has been defined by one clinician as a not-know strategy. That's how the person stays safe and protected, by not knowing. And so that it is very hidden by the very nature of the disorder itself. And then another track is I have a friend who grew up in India, and I invited him to sit in with a session with me one time. He's a third or fourth generation Christian from India. He's highly trained. He knows Dr. John Stott personally and has traveled all over the world. He's worked at Torchbearers, which is founded by Major W.N. Thomas. So he's a very good teacher and well-established, you know, speaker in a number of venues. And he was visiting with me, and I said, well, his name is Jonathan. I said, would you like to sit in and observe, you know, working with this highly complex multiple? And he said, sure. And I asked the girl, and she said, that'd be fine. So we sat in and went into a number of areas, and there were demonic manifestations in one of the areas that we were working with, and we worked maybe 2 hours or so, and when it was all through, I mean, he just got up and hugged this person. He said, I'm just so sorry to see what happened to you. I mean, he was really broken by what he saw, and he didn't fully understood all that he saw, but here's what he told me after we left and we were alone. He said, you know, Doug, he said, I grew up in India. He says, there, the enemy, you know, the Satan, he is a roaring lion. I mean, he's right out there in the open in our culture. And you see demonized people everywhere. I mean, it's just everywhere, and it's in your face. He says, well, you know, when I came to the United States and I began to travel and speak among the churches, and this is what he said, I see the same level of demonization right here in America, right in the churches, but it's different. Over there, the enemy is like a roaring lion. Over here, everything is covered up with a religious facade, and he's masquerading as an angel of light. But he said, I see the same level of demonization in our churches. Okay, the third, I said two different lines of thinking. The third one is, a number of years ago, I think it was in the early 90s, I went to the first annual conference on ritual abuse and mind control.
Was this a Christian conference?
No, it was secular. There were professionals, there were psychiatrists, psychologists. There was nothing going on in the Christian realm at that time. It was in the early 90s. And so I was trying to learn all that I could to try to help our people, because, I mean, there was just nothing out there, you know, at all. And I was trying to learn at least something of what I'm dealing with. And so I went to this conference, and there were a number, and I had this kind of Dave Hunt mentality, you know, psycho-heresy, and I was really against anything that was quote-unquote psychological. But I got out there, and I started meeting some of these secular professional psychologists and psychiatrists, and they had all been to graduate school, and they didn't know how to deal with this stuff. And they were working with people pro bono, and they had a genuine desire to see people helped, and they were there to learn. And so I gained high respect. I mean, here are people that are paying money to go to a seminar to help people that can't even pay them for their therapy. And that spoke loud to me that, you know, that my view of these people and their work was very slanted and very arrogant and misinformed. And even though they don't have all the answers, and they know they don't have all the answers, you know, at least they were trying to learn. So I was at this conference. Dr. Alan Shefflin, who is a Jewish person, unbeliever, professor of law at San Jose State University, gave a whole history of abuse and mind control under the aegis of the CIA. And you know, Dr. Ewan Cameron and all that fiasco up there in Montreal. I heard a whole lecture on that. And then I met Daniel Ryder there, who is an author, and, you know, and he wrote a number of books, cover up of the century, satanic ritual, crime, and world conspiracy. Met him there. And then there was a lecture that was given by a man by the name of Dr. Corey Hammond. Dr. Corey Hammond at that time was the president of American Psychiatric Clinical Hypnosis or whatever. But he was well known. And he gave the famous Greenbaum speech. So if you go online and look up Dr. Corey Hammond, Corydon Hammond, Greenbaum speech, you can find it online. I was there when it was presented.
C-O-R-E-Y?
Hammond, H-A-M-M-O-N-D.
Okay,
Corydon, I think it's C-O-R-Y-D-O-N, I think, Hammond. But it's called the Greenbaum speech, G-R-E-E-N-B-A-U-M. And the reason for that, Greenbaum was most likely a code name for Dr. Mengele, who was protected and was used, to perfect some of these techniques, the Nazi doctor. So anyway, he said this. Somebody asked him a question. I'll never forget this. He said, and it's in the Greenbaum speech, I believe. They asked him, he says, Dr. Hammond, I said, you consult people from all over the world, and here this man is an unbeliever. And, you know, in terms of ritual abuse and all this, he says, how prevalent is it? And here's what he said. There is not a city, there is not a community of anywhere in the world where this is not going on at some level. I have had people call me from all over the world, and this is what they say. It feels like I'm at the center of this activity where I live. It's really big going on where I live. He says, I heard that so many times that I came to the conclusion that it's represented in every place in the world that people have called him for consultation. So, you know, 1 John chapter 5, verse 19 says this, the whole world, that is the whole world of mankind, dead in trespasses and sin, under the rule of Satan, the whole cosmos diabolicus, the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. Well, do we believe it or do we not? And if the whole world does lie in the power of the evil one, who are we to say the nature and character of the mystery of iniquity that is now working, 2 Thessalonians 2:7, how do we know? If it's a mystery, that is, the Greek word means secret, how do we know unless we're baptized in that realm and walk into that realm? We don't know. So most of what we see is undercover. it's secret, because Satan has, he's not omnipotent guy. He's a finite creature, and the only way he can maintain his agenda is through stealth. He must stay hidden if he's going to be successful to any degree. And God operates in the light. The enemy can't afford to, so he must keep it hidden. And DID is a perfect realm where he can hide himself and carry out an agenda. So he is able to use the abuse of a scenario to carry out his particular agenda, so the person doesn't even know. You know, there's a movie I watched a number of years ago called Telephone by, what's his name? Charles Bronson was in it. Telephone, I think it's T-E-L-E-F-O-N-E, I think. But anyway, it was a movie about Soviet agents that had been planted in the United States, and they were programmed under certain cues to destroy the infrastructure of our country. You know, destroy power grids and all that kind of thing. And so Charles Bronson was called into this KGB or whatever it is, this Soviet, you know, secret service guy, the director of all this program. And he was being ordered to go to the United States because the Cold War is going to be over, and to assassinate all these people so that, you know, they wouldn't carry out their agenda and cause a war. And so Charles Bronson, he asked him, he says, well, why don't you just call him back? And he says, you don't understand. We can't call him back. Why can't you call him back? He asked him a question, what is a secret agent? And Charles Bronson says, well, one who's sent over to do secret ops and carry out a clandestine operation. And this director kind of laughed and looked at him. He says, not at all. A secret agent is a person who doesn't know he's a secret agent. That's in the movie. So that's what we're dealing with.
So I live in a town of 50,000, roughly. And from what the Greenbaum speech and this doctor is saying, Hammond, and probably from your experience as well, you're saying it's a safe bet that there's one or two or ten groups that are purposely doing ritualistic abuse on people, and even in this small community.
Well, the demographics, like Dr. Colin Ross, who is a secular Jewish psychiatrist, he said this, that when he did demographic studies on population, and he said he saw that about 10% of the population in various areas that he tested showed dissociative symptoms. If you take 10% of that 10%, you would have full-blown DID, according to the range of experience that he has been testing. So if you took 1% of a population, you've got 300 million people in the United States, and 1% were, you know, structured DID, you have enough to do some pretty significant damage.
Hmm. So even 1%.
And they're going to be dispersed and centered in that which is most strategically important to the adversary.
Like points of government, church, or bank?
Absolutely, yeah. Government, yeah. They come in. Yeah, you know, to places where there can be, you know, the adversary can carry on his agenda without necessarily the person even knowing fully all that's going on.
Yeah, are people doing things and then they don't remember doing them?
Oh yeah, I mean, in other words, if they switch into another personality state, the host person will be completely amnesic. Usually, they call it lost time. For example, I was just talking to a person here where I live who just gone through 4 years of, it wasn't with me, it was another person. She was abused by her grandfather, richly abused, and she was telling me that she had an alter that was trained to be an assassin. She didn't even know it. The way she found out is that her boyfriend wanted to take her out shooting. He said, would you want to go? And she says, well, I don't know, I've never been shooting. He said, come on, we'll go out and I'll teach you how. So they go out there and he brings a gun. She'd never handled a gun before, so he's showing her, and they set up the targets. And then as she was telling me the story, she said, you know, I don't know how much time went by, but I was all, the last thing I remember is my boyfriend saying, how did you do that? And she said, how did I do what? I said, how did you get, I mean, you got everything in the, you got everything in the 10 circle. You know, right in the 10, which is right in the bullseye. She says, I don't know. I don't even remember shooting. So the host person was totally amnesic. When that gun was handed to her, she switched into a trained assassin part of her, and she emptied the clip and put them all in the 10.
Would this have involved a period of her life to where when she was in that other personality, she went through months or longer of extensive training?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that part would have been created whenever, maybe it was a little girl, and then when they call out, they're able to call out different parts, and then they can train them to do whatever they need them to do, depending on the purpose of that original split. If they're, you know, if they're you know, depending the framework, if they're a protector or, you know, I mean, it depends on the framework of how they would be trained to do a particular task. But through it's called trauma-based mind control. You know, you get them in those different states, and they will become compliant to whatever the trainer or programmer directs them to do. They will be compliant. They'll use torture until they are compliant.
Oh, wow.
It's called trauma-based mind control.
So within an average community, there's groups doing this to people.
Oh, of course. You know, they have... If it's generational, the parents do it to their children because the parents did it to them. And they just, you know, if you saw the movie Sybil, you know,
yeah,
that wasn't ritual abuse per se, although the sadistic abuse, the mother, I've got the uncut version of Sybil, which is still, you know, Dr. Cornelia Wilbur was the doctor. And the uncut version is even more well-defined. But in the, one of the scenes where the mother is abusing Sybil, she takes the little girl in the kitchen, lays her on the table, and does horrific things to her. And here's what she says, gotta do it. I gotta do it. Gotta do it. Why? Well, my guess is that it happened to her, so now she's got to do it to her kid. She switches into some alternate state, and she perpetrates on her children the very same thing that was done to her. And that's why it's a familiar abuse. That's the dynamics. That's how it works. It's very, very tragic, but this is the pattern. And that, you know, it escalates according to the family you're born into and the basic spiritual agenda that would drive the whole thing.
So you mentioned someone who was trained to shoot or perhaps assassinate. Other than Columbine and school shootings and things like that, I don't hear a lot of random assassination reports in the news. There's a bunch of people trained for this that are just on call when a need arises?
Well, in the book, you know, when Daniel Ryder came and visited us, you know, in the book I mentioned, in chapter 16, he wrote a section where he quotes me. And let's see.
I tried to link to that book on Amazon, but there were none listed in stock. For anybody interested in this topic, I do have another book by Daniel Ryder on satanic ritual abuse linked from livefromroswell.com right now, just based on your recommendation there, Doug.
Yeah, no, he's a very thorough investigator, very objective. He just goes and gathers the facts. But he says, this is quoting this, this was in the early 90s, he said, takeover strategies. Doug Riggs was also at a seminar in Richmond. Riggs is the pastor of such and such church in Tulsa at that time. Reports of counseling 14 people in his congregation who have been conditioned with this high ultra-level programming. It is his belief these people were programmed and sent to this geographic area, as other clusters of operatives may have been sent to other areas. The participation in the church on one level was merely part of the front. From the information he's gleaned so far, Riggs too said he believes the world takeover scenario is not only in progress, but in its last phases. The mystery of iniquity isn't really the takeover, said Riggs. That's written about in Revelation. The real mystery has been how it is being done. Riggs also believes the Illuminati, that is, you know, those that are heads of the New World Order, as have the ruling masters who are orchestrating the plan. Riggs said he believes these ruling masters are actually a rung below a globally renowned group of royal families who control a large portion of the international banking. Riggs said this control has apparently been one of the key elements in the evolving takeover. Many governments are in debt to international bankers, and through this debt, banking institutions theoretically would control and dictate certain aspects of politics, thus covertly setting the stage for what is to come. For example, some of the illuminists may have already been placed in key government positions, and others are waiting in the wings, said Riggs. Riggs said he was able to access the information about this, about these renowned families, what has been known historically as the Illuminati and so on, to alter personalities, and have been programmed into some of the people he's been working with. He, too, said he has learned, according to survivor reports, there is a network of programmed assassins and other quote-unquote agents throughout the world that are a part of the takeover plot. He said, referring to myself, he has learned from survivors, some highly skilled neurologists and other programmers have reportedly been used to build these complex alter personality systems into these operatives. Dr. Josef Mengele is one, Dr. John Bowlby, if you go online, John Bowlby, who is the attachment pioneer on attachments, Dr. Jean Piaget, the people like this who are some of the programmers, or some of the pioneers in this field. Riggs also believes that some of this is being carried out by demonic intelligence, which is highly evolved and could account for the high degree of sophistication, and one of the reasons it has been all kept as covert as it has for so long. However, Riggs believes God is now allowing it to be exposed. He, referring to myself, gave a brief example of how he believes these demonic dynamics play an extremely significant part. That is, as mentioned before, as the person is being tortured, say through electroshock, they dissociate. And in this state, alter personalities are created, programmed by the perpetrators. What's more, the perpetrators will sometimes also perform rituals to channel the demonic spirits into the victim. These demons will attach to cult-created or aligned alter personalities. The demonic influence, Riggs said, he believes, works to sabotage the recovery process and keep the deep levels of the programming secret. The demons are also reportedly capable of highly advanced telepathy, astral projection, that is being able to travel through space at high rates of speed, etc. The demonic influence, said Riggs, is like adding another exponent to the sophistication of the programming. Riggs said he believes Satan is setting up the core of his takeover, the core of his earthly kingdom, through this process, and I would add, in these last days. That is, through a legion of people who are at the core of their being, are demonically controlled and will automatically respond to any dark side base command or cue. And that's just part of the section that he wrote. He spent a week with us doing this part of his documentary.
Well, how would that play out? Or I guess what I'm asking is, are all these people that are programmed just waiting on one master cue to come over CNN or something, and then something big kicks in?
Well, I don't really know how when you use the word master cue, right now we know things are in place through the military. What's the headquarters there? And I forget what they call it, Centrum or whatever. I forgot the actual title of the description of the military structure, because it's getting late here for me. But just the example, if in a state of emergency, there is a criteria that would establish a declaration of martial law. In other words, if there was a certain attack or dirty bombs go off in some of our ports, whatever, that would create a need, if you will, of martial law. Under martial law, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights are suspended, I'm told, for up to 6 months. Habeas corpus is no longer a viable protection for the average citizen. and therefore, you know, you can have, you know, military, National Guard operating as police, and even foreign troops. So in such a time of national crisis or national emergency, that in and of itself can be the cue. There can be a number of cues that are given over the national emergency broadcasting. Just certain phrases. If you saw the Manchurian Candidate, would you like to play a little? Would you like to play a hand of solitaire? And the guy immediately goes into his mode. You see, you know, just there's certain phrases that are that represent cues, and so there are a number of scenarios that are possible. But my guess is that anything that would be associated with a national emergency, and which would be followed by martial law, will be a major cue for operatives to go and carry out whatever they've been assigned to carry out.
So other than assassination, like you mentioned that there's people in churches and in banks and government, what would these people do if they were cued?
Well, they could do a number of things. I mean, assassination is only one scenario. The other is they could bring forth all kinds of incriminating evidence over existing politicians where they'd have to resign, and so whoever is in the wings to take their place are the very people that have been planned and designed to fill the vacuum. Just blackmail, just like the New York governor. I just read the other day.
Yeah,
that
didn't come to mind.
Yeah, I mean, there's many things. I mean, there's who's in the replacement. I'm not saying that guy, you know, is not a good guy. I don't even know. But, I mean, I'm just using that as an example.
How have you seen this play out in the church? Have people ever been triggered within the church to wreak havoc or do something odd?
It's really clandestine. I'm working right now at a place where a person is very, very spiritual in the same way. Former church where I was working, a guy came right alongside, had all the right spiritual language. He was kind of not a co-pastor, but he was very close in the counseling, and he was, looking back on it now, I mean, even with all the right language and everything, he was a phony through and through. It was, you know,
I
remember...
Did he know he was a phony, though?
At one level, at one level, but on the presenter level, I mean, he was just an equivocator. He was just an adapt and basically go along with whatever you say. But, yeah, I mean, it's real slick. I mean, I remember meeting Dr. Jerry Mungadzi, who is a renowned expert in this field. Dr. Jerry, if you go to Mungadzi, Dr. Jerry, Jerry Mungadze, Mungadzi. He has a clinic, and he is a forensic expert. He also is a lecturer in a Christian college on dissociation and trauma. He told me years ago, he said, the most difficult to detect in terms of people, the dissociation, is the illuminous Christian, as he called them. He called them illuminous Christians. He said they are the most difficult to detect. I remember working with one person one time. I sent to Jerry. And after he came back after a month, I mean, the guy, you know, it's just real bizarre. But Jerry said he was one of the top five most programmed males that he's ever worked with, and he's been working in this field for over 30 years. Huh. And when I was working with this guy, he had 100 altars in his presenter system alone to carry out different Christian functions and roles.
Christian roles?
Christian, to be in church. He was so fragmented, just in his presenter alone.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Jerry told me. I thought, my gosh, and I look back on it, we hadn't even got past the presenter into the core. So, I mean, you're talking about this kind of structuring. You try to explain this to the average, fundamentalist preacher, they're going to think you're from Mars, guy. I mean, where are you coming from? First of all, I remember talking with, many people know, what's his name, Dr. Neil Anderson. He's written The Bondage Breaker, a number of books. Really a fine guy. And I was at a seminar with him one time, and I read his third book. This is about 10 years ago. And those that have heard Neil speak or read his books, like I mentioned, The Bondage Breaker, Victory Over the Darkness, you can get them. They're still very good reading by Dr. Neil Anderson, a former engineer, now serving the Lord full-time. But, I read one of his books and two chapters on MPD, and I said, this is not the way it works. And so So, I took him aside as we were at a seminar one time. I said, Neil, I said, you know, what you just described, I mean, there's some truth in it, but it's very simplistic, and it's not how it works. And so I told him how it works and, you know, what's going to be involved. You know what he told, you know what Neil told me? He said, if it's that much work, if you got to do that, who's got time for it? I don't. I said, you going to tell people like me and other people out there that are trying to help these people? And he was very frustrated, and he walked away. You know, and I saw him 2 years later, and he got up and before 800 people, and he apologized for, you know, making statements about MPD at the time. He says, I was in kindergarten then, and now I'm about in the second grade, and so please forgive me for my ignorance and my presumptuous statements.
Wow.
And this is a guy that's a doctor. I mean, he's a guy that works with counseling and travels all over the world.
Yeah.
And I went up to him after. I said, Neil, I said, the very fact that you humbled yourself and made an apology was so healing to those multiples that you offended 2 years ago. So I just want to thank you for demonstrating that humility. And he looked at me. He says, I can't afford not to be humble. That was his attitude. So I just appreciate that because there's so many people in the church. If they don't, when this, I mean, I'm dealing with it here now. It's so beyond their ability to comprehend. They say, well, that's this psychology, or that's Christianized psychology, and, you know, where do you find this in the Bible? You know, they have no framework for it, and so they go into denial. And so, I mean, I can understand it, but it's better to take a place of humility and find out from the people involved what is their story. Let them speak, and when they speak, they have a lot to say, but they're not going to speak unless they believe they're going to be believed.
That's actually, you mentioned something we talked about during a break, is where is this found in the Bible? How are you going to, you had like some topics on that, or
yeah.
Someone challenges you with that.
Yeah, if somebody does, I'll send, because I can't put out my email because I can't answer. I mean, I already have more than I can deal with now.
Yeah.
I will send you two articles, maybe three, articles that I wrote because people in churches were wanting to know what is the biblical framework for this. So I wrote actually three articles, one called The Broken Hearted, the other called Pulverized Saints, where I use the, you know, I go to the scripture just so we can see a biblical framework that this is described in the Bible, although it's not specifically spoken about. Like he came to heal the brokenhearted and to bind up their sorrows in Isaiah 61, 1 through 3. The word brokenhearted, the Hebrew shaver, is in the plural. It's a comprehensive term. It means to be shattered. He came to heal the shattered heart. Well, it doesn't say MPD, but MPD is...
But it applies, I guess.
It is a shattering of the mind. It is a brokenness that is to the maximum. And in fact, in the Luke account in the King James, the Greek there is to be, it represents, it's like a pulverization. Then on pulverized saints, as I mentioned earlier, there's the Hebrew term daka, which means to be pulverized. It means to be, the Hebrew daka means to, it can be, you know, it can be panic on one side or shattering on the other side. And so it has kind of a dual range of description. Of someone because of a state of terror is pulverized. Well, that's pretty typical of someone who is under trauma, splits and fragments in what we call DID. So what I'm saying is that the language of Scripture certainly is descriptive of the phenomenon today, even though it doesn't use the present-day diagnosis DID as found in DSM-4. You see? In other words, it's within the framework of biblical description, even though we don't have the exact terminology.
Yeah, I'll have you email me that article. You said you can't give out your email now, but if you'll email me those articles, if anybody listening wants to email
right.
me at talktome@livefromroswell.com, I'll send it along.
Sure, and that will be in Word docs. So you can just send it with your email as a Word document, and they can just open it up and print it out.
Yeah, that'd be great. That reminds me of an email I had for you. Let me get to that. It's not signed, so I won't read it. Read aloud. Hi. Oops. Where'd it go? Okay, hi. I believe I used to have DID and that God led me through a long process of healing in which I gained full access to the memories of dormant personalities, and I feel they have been integrated and merged fairly well. I'm a Christian and I believe God has healed me of MPD, and I have faith that God did it well. But sometimes when I feel a lack of faith in God, I will feel scared and I will start to worry or feel frightened that perhaps I'm not healed, and I fear that there is some unknown personality that I'm unaware of, and I feel terrified that I am really not healed. My question is it normal for people that are recovered from MPD to sometimes feel scared that they aren't recovered and that some unknown personality is still present? Second question, just the idea that I'm not healed feels traumatic to think about. Frightening, is that normal? Any idea why I feel this way? Unsigned.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I can empathize with that, and I don't know why she feels that way without, unless I was personally interviewing her. But, you know, in a situation like that, just the fear itself, there's a way to trace that and to see where it's coming from, what the message is there. And if there's some pockets that need to be excavated a little bit to release that fear, that's pretty easily done with somebody who knows what they're doing. So she has a good counselor just to embrace that and follow that fear back to its source and say, okay, what is the message? Why do I feel this way? And it may take her back to some area that needs to be resolved. It doesn't mean that God hasn't done a tremendous work of healing. It doesn't mean that the work that has been done is not valid. It just means if there's some pockets here and there that need to be excavated and for her to be released, that's not unusual for people coming out of this history. So fear can be a doorway back to reclaiming an area of her life that she may not have reclaimed, or it could be just an area she may need to stand in terms of spiritual warfare and being built up in the Lord, or a combination of both. So it's not unusual to have these fears, and I think that as you grow in the Lord and you get more confidence in who you are and in your relationship with the Lord, that helps. But if there's any remaining dissociation, I wouldn't be afraid of it. It doesn't invalidate what she's already gone through. It just means that there may need to be a little bit more excavation to bring whatever's surfacing to resolution.
No, thanks for the thought-filled answer. That was a kind of a paragraph-form question. On one of the documents you sent me, Ritualistic Abuse, the Chalcedon Report,
yes.
There's a statement that caught my eye. It says, the Christian church must become more aware of the reality of ritualistic abuse. How are you or others working to that end? And frankly, from a pastor point of view, like say you've got a small-town church pastor that he doesn't feel like this is going on, therefore he's not worried about it. It doesn't enter into his thinking. It's like, why should he care?
Well, you know, the spiritual level of each person is going to determine their ability to even have an aptitude to go into this realm. I mean, if they already got their mind made up, it's not relevant. You know, they can believe about Antichrist, they can believe about New World Order and teach it as a doctrine. But the real question, where does that intersect people's lives? And,
yeah.
You know, demographically, we have 30 to 35% of all women in the United States that have had some form of sexual abuse. Now, if that was chronic in childhood, they're going to have some major issues that need to be resolved and very often dissociative issues. So if you're a pastor in a local church and you're really interested in seeing people restored, you're first going to have to face the reality of this rather than just think that teaching the truth is going to resolve them, because just teaching objective truth does not resolve someone of a traumatic past. It's kind of a magic thinking, you know. Just, you know, give them a few verses, pray over them, and, you know, trust the Lord and everything will be fine. Well, you know, if somebody comes along and hits you in the leg with a baseball bat and you break your leg, it doesn't matter whether you're a believer or unbeliever, you're going to have to get the bone set so it can heal. And there's a certain analogy to that when there's trauma in a person's life. Trauma is trauma, whether you're a believer or unbeliever, and there are symptoms, and you have to deal with the fallout and the effects of trauma. And so if you're a pastor and you're really interested in helping people, you're going to have to understand trauma. And if not, you're going to have to somebody on staff that is willing to go into this area and be trained. Dr. Jerry Mangazzi is teaching at a Christian college there in Dallas, and he's been teaching for 10 years, writing the curriculum on trauma, traumatology, as part of the training of those who are going into ministry to work and counsel those who have a trauma past, with 30 to 35% of the women having some level, different levels of sexual abuse in their childhood. You're going to have to do something to help these people, and we're not even talking about ritual abuse in this. So yeah, the church is really, you know, I mean, everybody's got their own belief as to how things should operate, but you know, we got to deal with things as they are, and the church in the West and the Western civilization, it is a pagan culture. It takes a different form, but we're just as pagan as pagan Rome.
Yeah. You
know? I mean, it's just the facts.
So, do you ever run into people that even deny that any sort of ritualistic abuse is happening, or at least prevalent?
Oh yeah, all the time. Because that's their reality. They know what what they don't know, they don't know. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, if they're proud, arrogant, or insecure, they'll speak all about what they don't know is fact.
Yeah.
But if they're humble, you know, they're willing to learn and listen, and maybe have to have a bigger God box. Maybe their whole God paradigm needs to be enlarged to accept the magnitude of this reality.
If they didn't come to you originally, do you have a way of, like, either documentation or anything?
Is happening? Yeah, I'll overwhelm them, the guy.
Yeah.
I can overwhelm them from many different angles, but, you know, the question is that help? So the best thing to do is try to find out where they are and to measure it out a little bit until they can adjust and come in and to have the capacity to even grasp some of these areas that we're talking about.
So I guess generally, unless a pastor, I mean, you said you started when you ran into counseling problems with people that you just couldn't get past.
That's right, yeah. We just hit an impasse.
And rather than write the person off and say, God bless you, I guess you actually began to pray about what is wrong or how can I help this person further? Is that what started it with you?
Well, that was involved, yes. I got informed. I mean, I heard about, you know, the dividedness and how it was then defined as multiple personality disorder. But my first thought is, where do you find this in the Bible? I'm not interested in going there. And so when I read Dr. Jim Friesen's book that was released in 1991 called Uncovering the Mystery of MPD, I just was reading through it. It was making sense to me, but I didn't know. So I shared some of the things I was reading with some of the folks that I was stuck with. And I was reading from the book about different parts coming out, child altars and that. And, there's a woman in front of me who was in her 40s, and we'd known her for 10 years, very intelligent person, professional. She's an RN. And I look over at her, and she's sitting with her knees up in her chest, sucking her thumb and rocking and looking at me with these cute little eyes. And, I've known this person for years. I said, have I met you before? She says, hi, my name is Sarah, and I like ducks and ice cream. I said, really,
wow.
Sarah? How old are you? She said, 6. I said, how come I never met you before? He says, because we didn't think we would be believed. But now you're reading that book. We believe that you will believe us now. Us now.
Huh.
And that journey began. And it's been a pretty awesome journey, not with her, but many others. So, I could say, well, where do you find what's in front of me? Where do you find that in the Bible? I didn't have time.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm talking to an adult that's in her 40s talking to me like a 6-year-old. And we knew her character. We knew that she wasn't a person that was, we knew her integrity. And so what is presenting... And then when I said, well, what happened to, and I mentioned the host person's name. Oh, she's here somewhere. I think she's watching. Okay. So going to get the host person back. I said, were you aware of that? Yeah, sort of. I said, were you aware that that was there? He says, no, I didn't have any clue.
So I guess with a split or a person that has many personalities, the goal is not exorcism, as in casting out that personality, but merging them, right?
Yeah. Now, some of the personalities, because of the abuse and the way they've been conditioned, tortured, they'll torture them till they become Satan, let's say. And so you'll get down in there and you'll get to a part called Satan. Well, what you have to do is decontaminate it, if you will, and clear off the spiritual contamination and release the little abused part to which the spiritual attachment is anchored. So it's not an either-or thing. You have to decontaminate it from the infestation and the invasion that occurred during the trauma, but there's a humanity there that needs to be released and ultimately integrated, yes.
How do you decontaminate a person?
It varies on the presentation and what you're dealing with, and if it's structured internally with other, it's usually a matrix, and it may be a shield or something, and there may be a higher level entity attached to a deeper part of the person that I may have to get there first and take out the one that's in more authority to release some of the more fragmented areas. It depends on where I am, and it's a strategy that evolved over 20 some years. So it's a military operation, basically. I mean, if you study the Art of War by Sun Tzu or anything, or read anything about military, the adversary is a very good strategist, and he knows how to hide himself. And when you're going into these areas of the dividedness, you have to find out how things are structured and where the command centers are, and take them out so you can release the humanity.
And then merge the personalities again through just prayer,
right?
Counseling.
Everything has to be merged into the host eventually. Whoever the primary presenting host is, whoever is seeking help, whoever is claiming to be the Christian, everything has to be owned and come into the present tense state of who the person is in everyday life.
Neat. We're down on our last minute. I'm going to remind people that if you are encountering a problem like this, or know someone is in church or not, Doug does not have a website, but you can email me, talk to me at livefromroswell.com, and I can forward to him. And as time permits, he'll answer. Are you pretty well networked around the country? Like if someone writes you and says, I'm from Miami, Florida, or I'm from Boise, Idaho, do you have people that you might refer them to, Doug?
Well, it's ironic. I am from Boise, Idaho.
Okay.
But yeah, no, what I'll do is if it's too much involved, then I can consider a phone time. I'm not really good at doing long emails, so... What I'll do is I'll look at it and then say if somebody wants to call me, I'll give them a time frame, and I'll be happy to do what I can to maybe give them some direction. If it's a counselor, that's a different matter. If it's someone who has an abuse history, I'm very careful of what I say so I don't trigger them.
Okay. Fascinating topic, and I know we just barely scratched the surface of it. I agree with you. More people, especially within the church, need to know about it if they've got people walking around in their midst hurting, though.
That's right. And if they're not called to it as a pastor, then there are plenty of folks in the congregation that are willing to get trained, that are just sitting there wondering how to be useful and fruitful, that are willing to come alongside and play some role. They just need to be encouraged and maybe have an opportunity to learn and to find out what their role is. And so to be educated and trained is really the key to helping many, many people who otherwise wouldn't get out.
Good final word. I thank you for joining us tonight, and I hope this has helped someone out there, or more than someone. Thanks a lot, sir. God bless.
All right. All right.
We're cutting out to music. Join us next week on Live from Roswell. Thanks for listening in tonight, folks. Bye-bye.